Hey everyone, and welcome back to Practically Zero Waste, a podcast for making zero waste living as practical as possible. When you think of savoring something, you likely think of some delicious dessert that you're enjoying completely. For me, I think of when fruit and veg like strawberries or tomatoes are in season and taste ridiculously better than they do the rest of the year. It's the act of celebrating something while it lasts to sustain us through the hard times when they aren't around. All that to say, when we think of our resources, water, food, money, time, energy, and more, the word conserving comes to mind. Instead, we're going to switch it up today and talk about savoring those things when we have an abundance and really cherishing those things or moments when there's less to go around. That is loosely today's topic on the podcast. Today, I talk with Lonnie Grafman, professor at Humboldt State University in California, to talk about his book, To Catch the Rain. We cover rainwater catchment, bringing renewable technologies to communities, and how to savor our resources that we far too often take for granted. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts by going to Practically Zero Waste page, scrolling to the bottom of the app, and telling me what you think. Okay, let's jump right in on how to catch the rain. So can you tell me about yourself and your work leading up to the publishing of your book?
Yeah, well, I love that question. it's, of course, a hard question to answer. I got my start as a homeless teen.
Oh,
working
wow.
in squats, trying to meet like our needed resources. But actually before that, I was also a homeless teen, but with a lot of anger towards the way the world was. I was really upset that some people had everything they wanted and others, they didn't have even the things that they needed. The inequities, the violence, like the pillaging of our environment, all that stuff just made me angry. I was kind of hell bent on destroying it.
Wow.
So that we could then start rebuilding afterwards. Unfortunately, I found that, or maybe fortunately, I found that that approach wasn't really working for me.
Yeah, wow.
Like, I wasn't changing people's minds, you know, like, no matter what I did, it wasn't, people's minds were, they weren't going like, oh, you're right, that system is bad. So I transitioned into kind of figuring out how I could try to create the world I wanted instead of destroying the world I didn't want, and then doing that with people. And then just through a series of luck and I'm sure also hard work, but a lot of luck, I somehow eventually found myself at university teaching people how to build these technologies that, you know, I spent a decade building and then transitioned into building and teaching.
Some of these technologies that we'll get into in a little bit, there's kind of one of those, like, one thing led to another, and then all of a sudden you're teaching a university. That's amazing.
Yeah, I did leave out a bunch of gaps, but yeah, we were building. So often out of waste materials or repurposed materials or found materials, and we're just making stuff, you know, and whether that was in a squat in an abandoned building or if that was on a piece of land that somebody had acquired and they were trying to build kind of an off-grid system, or if it was in apartments or rooftops in New York. But yeah, we just kept building.
So tell me about the technologies that you were working with or building for people.
So, for instance, we've built schoolrooms out of plastic bottles that catch their own solar power and their own rainwater.
Cool.
So they're energy independent and water independent, and there's now students who can go to school in that community before who couldn't have, but we built it out of just waste materials, plastic bottles, sawdust, broken tiles.
That's awesome.
So that'd be one example.
Wow.
Right now, in any given month, I'm working on water projects, energy projects, construction, food, medical devices, entrepreneurship, all types of stuff. And I come into these projects as a technology and as a university instructor on energy and design and entrepreneurship and technology. But really, I'm just wearing all that stuff as a Trojan horse. I mean, hopefully like a positive Trojan horse.
Yeah.
But I'm wearing that technology as a Trojan horse for community, because at the end of the day, like, the only technology I truly believe in, that I truly believe will save us, is community.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to work about half of my projects in poor communities, a quarter of my projects in rich communities, and then a quarter kind of in between. So, you know, in any given few months, I might have some projects in a community that makes $1 or $2 a day, is like the average salary per person.
Mm.
And then also a project like in New York City. So for instance, in New York City, we had, I don't know if you saw this project, we have this floating food forest. So 5,000 square foot barge that we've filled with hills and trees and hundreds of native
what?
Plants that are medicinal, and people can just come pick that food for free.
What?
And it goes from port to port.
That's awesome. That's amazing. So what you're doing is you're taking sustainable technologies or technologies that are meant to help communities become self-sufficient, resilient, sustainable, that sort of thing, and bringing them these technologies, helping them to build it so that they don't need to rely on a broken system that isn't meeting their needs, whatever it may be, or wherever it may be.
I love that. Yes, please keep that.
Well, cool. Yeah.
That's so, my answer.
Well, I love it because you're absolutely right that the main point of all of this, or the core that's at the center of all of this, is community. Because once you have that group of people that is working towards the common goal of self-sufficiency or whatever it is, taking care of your planet, taking care of your people, making everybody have a living wage or whatever it is, you're creating jobs, you're creating technologies that are serving this group. You need that core group to be strong. And so I love all of these things, and I love how it's all tying together into this kind of ongoing conversation on the podcast about community and resiliency, especially in a time like coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this stuff is always important. I often call my work epi-apocalyptic. Right? I do lectures on apocalyptic technologies, and recently I did the opening talk for Tank Girl, and then before that I did it for Mad Max, like in an old theater. And I call it epi-apocalyptic technologies because the idea is that I've always felt like I'm in this race against the impending apocalypse. And mm-hmm. So I'm trying to focus on technologies that can prevent that. But also, if it doesn't, technologies we can use to rebuild afterwards. Right. It has been a really interesting time right now, I think, where for a lot of rich people, this is the first time that they've had to feel this feeling of, mm-hmm. oh my God, what if we don't make it? What if there isn't enough? You know, and of course, it's a feeling that I think poor people, if you're in a community that makes under $2 a day as your average salary, you know, you're really used to the fact that if you get sick, you might not get helped. So it's an unfortunate time to be coming to these technologies and coming to community, but it would be a silver lining. Like right now, if we do things well, we can use this as a trial run for the next big thing.
Right? Oh my gosh, I just got chills because that's exactly like the big thing, the big message I want to push right now is, well, in our case, the zero waste community like has been talking about how we're not doing too badly as far as having to not go to the store anymore and stay indoors and stay making do with what we have, just because that's right. That's been kind of the message that we've been promoting for so long. So yeah, I love
that. Yeah, and if we do things fantastic, it could even be a wake-up call to know we need to be doing those things, right?
Wouldn't that be great? It is a silver lining in this time because there's little joy in this time. Well, right. I mean, because of all of the social justice and death and everything that's happening from this pandemic. But, you know, if there's anything that we can take away from this, it should be that we need to learn as a society how to be a little bit more resilient and take better care of the planet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I am no way making light of the current situation. But, you know, this has always been the situation. Mm-hmm. Like the situation has, for all of us that are alive right now, for our entire lifetime, it's always been that people are dying unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And it's always been that there's been an unequal distribution of wealth. And it's always been that there's people that are using way more than they should. And I'm one of those people. I use way more than I should. Because 7 months of the year I live in the US and it's just like I don't even know how to get there as an individual, which is why I focus on classes and community projects. Mm-hmm. Right now I have a student teacher teaching a class on becoming zero waste.
Ooh, at that's
Humboldt State
fun.
University.
That's cool.
It's super cool. I just got off online meeting with her and the other four teachers to figure out how we're gonna do this online. Mm-hmm. You know, and she was really excited because she's already been teaching for the last 8 weeks teaching students how to make do with less. And she's like, well, this is amazing opportunity for a trial run on that.
Yeah, the practical side of the class right yeah. away.
You know, I'd love to give you one more example of a project, a rainwater project.
Sure.
To kind of bring them together. This is one that you reminded me of when you're talking about how your podcast is really becoming about community resilience. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this book, To Catch the Rain, a couple years ago because I wanted to be able to have more impact without traveling as much. Mm-hmm. And I presented the book at an event for local teachers, and teachers could pick whatever meeting they came to. And so some came to mine, and I ran it as a break-off group. So I presented the book to them, and then I had them break off with butcher paper and crayons and kind of design stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the teachers who came, Heather Nyberg, she just kind of came on a whim. She wasn't like, oh my God, sustainability projects, that's what I need to be doing. She just is like, oh, this one looks fun. And, you know, when I said, okay, what do we want these breakoff groups to be? She's like, you know what? The school I work at would be perfect for this. She's like, I want to design my school. So she kind of drew her school up, and she had some teachers join her team. Then they started drawing up plans. And then 6 months later, she ended up working with one of my student teams. They built a 4,000 gallon rainwater catchment tank. And now that system is feeding all of the water for a 1 acre pumpkin farm, where they take their students and teach their students about business and agriculture. They grow the pumpkins and then they sell them in the fall.
Awesome.
And it's growing an acre of corn and an acre of community garden now. Their school, I think, is 97% of the students are on assisted lunch program. And now all of their lunches have food that they grew.
That's amazing.
And you know, it's just those, this person wasn't like a true believer in sustainability projects, but she said, you know what, I want to do something with my school. And then this student team was like, oh, we want to be part of that. And then these local ag people were like, yeah, we'll be part of it. And they just kind of built up this system. And now, you know, when the power ran out here, they still had plenty of water, you know. and also those 4,000 gallons are fairly future proof for times when things run out.
Wow, I love that. Okay, so tell me specifically about your book and how that kind of came together, but especially how we can apply what you can learn in your book about rainwater harvesting, rainwater catchment in our regular lives, really practically.
I like that.
Yeah, is it just for large scale projects? Can individual homeowners take advantage of rainwater collection? Should more people be doing this? How does it work?
Yes.
Answer all my questions.
I appreciate that. The first and easiest question is that this book is targeted towards individuals and very small community groups.
Great.
You can use it for large scale projects, but I really think if you're trying to do a project for 1,000 people, you should probably hire a professional.
Sure.
And I'm hopefully there's enough resources. If it's 1,000 people, you can all chip in, right? But if you're trying to do this for 100 people, or you're trying to do it for a school, maybe your school has 1,000 people, but you're only trying to provide enough for the school garden, this is the right size.
Cool.
The book is split into three parts. One part is just inspirational stories from different communities I've worked in around the world and how they used water. We have a school in Dominican Republic, and we also have a school in the U.S., we have a community in Chiapas that 3 months of year, they're having to drink surface water because the dry season is so long.
Wow.
And so waterborne illness is a major issue. And they did something really amazing, which as somebody who's very identified with being from the United States, it's not a plan I would have come up with on my own, because I kind of have this stark individualist thread in me. But what they did is they had three roofs, two different homes and families collecting water into one above ground ferrocement tank for storage. And then that water is being used for everyone in the community. It's a small community. But I just love the communal nature of it. These different roofs, different families collecting into one tank, and then that tank being shared with everyone, you know, really beautiful.
Fantastic.
And in fact, I encourage people to just read those stories and have the book just in case, but at least they have the stories for inspiration. And then a third of the book is very how-to, and I go into materials, all types of materials. So when I'm talking about a gutter, I'm not just looking at the K-type gutters you can buy in the US. I'm looking at PVC. I'm looking at bamboo. I'm looking at metal roofing that you've bent into shape.
Yeah.
Just all, you know, all the different ways that you can do it with stuff that you can find in whatever community you're in.
Perfect.
And the same is true for roofs and storage systems. And then another third of the book is science and math. So if you really want to size your system, like really appropriately, really design it and get all the math and science, you can do that as well. You don't have to, right? You can build a rainwater catchment system without any math. You can be like, this is what size, I have these 55 gallon drums and I'm going to fill these, right?
Hook them up to my
and
roof.
It'll work.
Yeah.
But if you want to know, hey, my roof is this big and this is how much water I'm using, how much storage will I need? Well, the math will lead you through that.
Amazing.
I should also mention that the book is written so that it could be used in education. So middle school, high school, and college education, there is the opportunity to use it in there. There's math problems at the back of the book if people want to do that. And I find that, you know, students who might not want to learn math, or even adults who don't want to learn math, all of a sudden their love of math changes when it becomes really practical, where they're like, oh, this is how much water it's going to catch. And then they watch it catch that, and they're like, did it? And they're like, yes, that is the amount that is that it worked. And so, add that as well.
That's really fun. Cool. So when we're talking about rainwater collection, say I'm in the city and I get my water from the municipal water tower, comes out of my tap. In my middle-class home in Canada, I don't have to worry about will the water come. Should I still be collecting my rainwater? And what are the benefits of doing that in the city?
What's been really fun for me is that I thought I knew all the different ways that people caught water and all the different reasons why. But since I've written the book, I've found a bunch more inspiring reasons that people have built rainwater. It's quite a varied list, right? The obvious ones are because water is necessary for life, and therefore you should catch it. But I found people that are doing rainwater catchment because they want to infuse a sense of environmental stewardship into their children. And so, you know, we're at this current situation, which is quite beautiful from a development point of view, where all of our resources are taken care of and they're fairly invisible. But unfortunately, that becomes a recipe for egregious abuse of our resources, right? When we don't see where the water is coming from and where it's going afterwards, we just kind of use it. And the same with our energy and our waste. If we don't see where it's coming from, where it's going to, then we don't even have a great sense of why we should conserve. So that's one of the reasons I see people doing it. Security in the face of climate change and global climate weirding and crazy governments. I don't want to get political. I don't know what country your listeners are in, but that happens sometimes.
Wow.
Then catching your own rainwater can help in that. In times of natural disaster, you know, I'm up here in Northern California most of the year, and it's certain that earthquakes will come.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've had a few in the last week, which is pretty scary. It's a scary time. We don't want the earthquake to come now. But we're also pretty remote, and we'll be some of the last people that get help. And so it makes additional sense to have rainwater catchment here for that. And the list goes on. Like, one of the reasons that I hadn't thought about is that some people don't trust what is being put in their water. You know, they don't want the chlorine. They want control over that. And so some people are catching water because they just want control over their water. Other people are catching it because they care about energy and chemicals. And there's a lot of embedded energy and chemicals in our water. It takes energy to move water all around our city. There's people who catch water because they want to stop the erosion happening around their house. So instead of having it fall on the impermeable surfaces and then on the ground, they're catching that to slow down that water. And the list just keeps going on. I've really learned since writing the book, I've learned a lot of really interesting reasons that people catch their own water.
That is so satisfying to talk about and think about environmental stewardship as being one of the reasons to catch water, to educate us about conserving resources of all kinds, not just water. I love that. I just use it to water my garden, but that's fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it's I'm kind of embarrassed that I definitely did not think of that one on my own, right? Like, I feel like with my job, I should have been like, oh, this is why. But no, it was really various parents. And it often was in the context of having children and people talking about raising these future environmental stewards.
Yeah, absolutely. So uses for rainwater catchment, obviously, anything that you use water for in your home. Most people who are catching rainwater or setting up these systems, like a cistern. So in my parents' home in the country, they catch all of the rainwater off of their roofs. It goes into a cistern, goes through like a UV filter or something like that, and then they drink it. So if I am catching it in my backyard off of my garage roof, can I drink that, or should I be filtering it? What should I do?
So my general advice is, if you're in a rich country, filter your rainwater, or just filter your city water, depending on what you want.
Yeah.
And then to use the water you catch to grow your vegetables, to water your ornamentals, to clean your car, whatever, anything else.
Right.
And in part, the reason I suggest that is because in a rich country, often, and by rich, I mean financially rich, mm-hmm. often the water coming to your house does not have immediate pathogens. You might be concerned long-term, and of course, there's plenty of rich countries like here in the U.S., if you're in Flint, Michigan, definitely the rainwater is a better call, right? But if you're going to drink it, I really suggest filtering it. That said, a lot of my colleagues are just laughing, you know, at me suggesting that. And it's probably, you know, I like to err on safety in this case, but a lot of my Australian colleagues don't, they have rainwater catchment, they don't filter at all. I've drank for years in Central America, I've drank rainwater without any filtration, and I felt very
alive,
comfortable. Yeah. and then also I'll use slow sand filters, and I feel really comfortable with those, which is just, it's pretty much just a drum filled with rock and sand, and then a small layer called a schmutzdeck of biologically active material sets up on top of it naturally. And then you can filter the water through that. And when I send the water in for water tests, it always comes back really good.
I was just thinking about charcoal filters as well. Is that mm-hmm. something that people have in rain barrels? I'm just thinking too that like sometimes a barrel of water in your backyard, and I don't know how interesting this is to other people, but I'm interested right now. If I just have that in my backyard, I'm not going to drink out of it right away because it has been kind of stagnant and scummy. So I don't know how to clean that and drink that.
Right. I mean, so slow sand filter will take care of that. Cool. You can also put activated charcoal in a slow sand filter, or you can do it outside of a slow sand filter. You can add a tiny bit of just a couple drops of bleach to a large amount of water, mm-hmm. and then put that through a charcoal filter. And now you have pathologically clean water and also good tasting water.
That is so cool. So back to the math that's in the book. How much rainwater could the average roof be collecting? Could you collect enough water to live off the grid in a way?
I mean, the short answer is yes.
Is that like a dumb question?
the long answer is, and this is why the math's in the book, the long answer is that you really have to kind of do the calculations. Mm-hmm. And the first step in for any of these resources, the first thing you got to do is figure out how you can save. Like, how can you conserve the amount of water that you're using, or energy, or whatever it is that you're looking for? We look for that conservation first. And then we go into, can you catch enough? And that's going to have to do with your roof area and also the amount of waterfall. Right? And so just to give an example, let's say you're just in the average place in the U.S. The U.S. on average catches about 28 inches a year of rain. So that's pretty reasonable. It's much less than where I live. Right. So let's say you're getting 28 inches of rain a year. And let's say you have a 2,000 square foot home.
That's a really big house.
I went for the U.S. Is that too big? Should I go smaller?
Yeah, go smaller.
Okay, let's say you had a 1,000 square foot home.
Yeah.
All right, I like that. Then you're going to catch about 16,000 gallons per year on your roof.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, so it's significant. Like, it's not – in fact, most of the time that I'm designing people's systems, they're worried they don't have enough rain. And I'm almost always telling them it's going to be the storage that's the issue. You probably have enough rain. It's can you store it all? So if you live in an area where those 28 inches fall in just 6 months on your 1,000 square foot roof, mm-hmm. do you have 8,000 gallons of storage to save you for the next 6 months?
You're going to have to like have a lot of baths to just, you know, use up some of your water.
Yeah, or let it run off, you know. But then if you have a long dry season, then you won't have water for the, you know, for part of that dry season.
I love how all of this really comes back to your first step, which was conservation and looking at how much you are consuming, so that you know. And I keep thinking of my parents living in the country with their sister, and like they are collecting rainwater and living off of that exclusively, and so they know that in the summertime it hasn't rained in a long time, and so maybe you can only do one load of laundry a week, or you have to stretch things and conserve water in a lot of ways in order to make it through those drier seasons.
Right, and you know, and that's something that we all used to be good at, right? It's like endemic to most culture to have been good at that at some point in time. But then when we're divorced from the resource, we just stop thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So you know, like your parents know, like in the summer, they're probably taking short showers and they're probably really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And I try to instill a sense of savoring our resources, not just being ultra conservative, but savoring and being like, oh, we have plenty of water right now. I'm going to take a long shower and I'm going to really enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, because I know that there's going to be some points in time that I won't have as much.
That is great. And that whole sense of living in tune with the seasons, with the environment, and not asking too much of the planet, and really savoring or really enjoying the abundance when it exists. Like, it's just so relaxing to think about that kind of lifestyle. Yeah.
No, there's something about being in tune with it that actually does bring some peace of mind. You know, even though it sounds like it might not be as convenient, I think that it can be really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. How much of a problem is our paved paradise sort of thing? So we've got so many driveways, so much of our roads and sidewalks and parking lots, they all are draining all of this rainwater, which would normally just be falling right into the ground and joining the groundwater. It's going into our sewer system. Is that something that cities should be looking at and trying to fix or avoid?
It is. And in fact, some cities, it's one of the reasons that they're encouraging rainwater catchment, is to try to lower that impact. So Mexico City is working with an organization called Isla Urbana, and they do small scale installations throughout the city. Their approach is excellent because they address kind of one neighborhood at a time. That way neighbors can help each other with any questions that they're having about using the system. And one of the reasons I think that Mexico is into that is because they're trying to figure out what to do with that very issue, right? And so when you have all these impermeable surfaces, rainwater, it no longer is a resource, it's a liability, because it ends up causing a lot of erosion. You're no longer refilling your water table. It's all running down and away. For a lot of sewers, a lot of wastewater systems, the sewer is tied to the wastewater. Mm-hmm. And even in places where it's not, a lot of times the sewer infrastructure is so leaky that when it rains, it starts infilling the sewer. But either way, in either of those cases, that can be a large impact on a wastewater treatment plant. One of the wastewater treatment plants that I work with, you know, they have about 1 million gallons per day flow through their wastewater treatment system, except when it's raining, and all of a sudden it's 14 million gallons per day.
Whoa!
But you could say, well, dilution is the solution to pollution, so it's okay because it's not that much more waste. But they still need to treat it all. It's their charter, and they can't just bypass their systems and be like, oh, don't worry, it's diluted. And so that is another way to address that. And I think it's going to depend on which community you're in and the size of the community and how much rainwater infrastructure you can put in. But it is another reason.
That's great. So you've got so many different apocalyptic technologies, so ones that are preparing us for apocalyptic times. Are you able to talk a little bit about your next book, which is called To Catch the Sun? Am I right?
You are right. Yeah. This might be the first time I'm talking about it publicly.
You heard it here first, folks.
Exactly. Breaking news.
Yeah.
First of all, like, I hope we don't need to have apocalyptic technologies, right? Like, I hope that these technologies just happen to be ones that'll work for that, but can help prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
In my school, we call them appropriate technologies, fitting for the time and the place and the community, and thinking about all the impacts. One of the problems with the way that we define technology in the world is that we don't really think too much about its externalities and long-term impacts. And a really big problem with the way we think about innovation is that we don't consider whether it makes the world a better place. And to me, it's not an innovation if it doesn't make the world a better place.
Yeah.
You know, Silicon Valley has this definition of innovation that's desirable. Do people want it? Viable. Can you make a business out of it? And feasible. Can it technically be done? But the problem with that, can you make a business out of it, is that's entrepreneurship. That's not innovation.
Right.
So I want to make the circles the same two that you have. You have desirable, do people want it? And you have feasible, can it be done? But the last one should be about justice. Is it worthwhile? If it doesn't make the world a better place, it is not an innovation. It might be a business, but it's not an innovation. And so in that same direction, the books that I want to write are about kind of open source technologies that people can then build businesses on top of.
Sure, yeah.
The first one was To Catch the Rain on rainwater catchment. And this next one will be very similarly set up, where you have one third of the book is stories, one third is how to, and one third is math and science. And this next one will be To Catch the Sun, which will be focused on small-scale solar power.
Yes. Oh, I'm so into that. That's great.
And I'm writing it with a co-author this time, a fantastic, prolific, brilliant author. His name is Dr. Joshua Pierce. When I met him, I think 15, 20 years ago, people used to call him Dr. Solar. So I'm really excited to be writing this book with him.
That's wonderful. So I love the idea of it being, again, practical. That's what I'm all about on this podcast, is trying to have such like a nice sampling of all of the different ways that we can help the planet and build resiliency and just be good people. Have like a nice sampling of all of the different options that people can deep dive into them a little bit more on their own. And so I would love to learn about small scale solar power, practical and something you can do DIY or install it yourself. How does solar power work?
So this book is focused much more on standalone systems, ones that aren't connected to the grid. You can use the book for grid-tied systems, and we do talk about it. Mm-hmm. But the focus of the book is really on these standalone systems that are powering devices that are not connected directly to the grid. Mm-hmm. And just like rainwater, it depends on how much air you have, and it depends on how many photons are falling on you, just like it depends on rainwater. So, you know, most places receive an average of 4 to 6 hours a day of what we call full sun. And so that's the amount of sun you'd be working with. And of course, and just like rainwater, the first question you want to ask is, what do I actually need? How can I save? Sometimes we call that negawatts. So how can you use less energy?
I like that.
and then you size the system. And so we're going to have designs and math for systems like, if you just want enough to run your laptop, or if you want enough to run your oxygen machine in case there's a planned power outage.
Wow.
Or if you want to run your school or your house, or you just want to have the gate opener for your parents' farmhouse.
Yeah.
You know, let's say that they have a goat, they want to, or a gate, they want to open and close that. Just a small little standalone solar. Those are the targets. So the targets are in a rich country, probably not your whole house, unless it's like a tiny home or a van. Van life, for sure. That's what we're sizing.
Cool.
Or in a poor country, maybe like a whole small community.
Wow. Because it's based on the usage, right?
Exactly. In the US, the average home uses 30 kilowatt hours per day. Those units don't mean much to people, but in California, the average is only 15 kilowatt hours a day. And me at my house, and I am not an extreme
conserver.
I lead a pretty normal life when it comes to how many of my resources I use, but I only use 1.5 kilowatt hours a day.
What? That's cool.
Yeah, but no one would notice. Like, no one would come here and be like, wow, you're like so many conservation efforts. It's just simple things.
You just like turn off the lights when you leave the room, or
it's really literally that simple. It's like LED lights, task lighting for wherever I'm at.
Right.
And also having a small home. It's funny that when you mocked me for sizing my system on a 2,000 square foot home, you're absolutely accurate. That's just, it's large. It's hard to power a home like that. Yeah. So I do have a small place.
Yeah, I mean, ours is probably 700 square feet or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a good size for what we need. And it makes it a lot cheaper. That's great.
Yeah, from all the ways. Like, cheaper in terms of how much time you spend cleaning it. Cheaper in terms of how much energy it's going to use.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
All of these ideas of renewable energy sources, the solar panels would be set up with energy storage. Like, are you using just batteries? Or I've heard of like using molten salt to store a lot of solar energy.
So our system will not be focusing on the molten salt. I love molten salt, but it really only works for large scale solar thermoelectric, where you have mirrors instead of electric panels.
And so cool.
They're reflecting that light up to the top of a tower, and they're melting the salt to use it as a working fluid. And then that salt is what's heating the water to run a steam turbine. One of the cool things about that is that you can keep generating energy even after the sun sets, because that salt has so much energy still stored in it.
Yeah, cool. But on a smaller scale, people are just storing
it. On a smaller scale, we're doing small scale solar electric. So directly to electricity, real simple systems that people can just put together themselves. Right now I have two groups working on solar charging for the homeless camps that you know, previously these unhoused people were being able to charge their cell phones at coffee houses and restaurants, but they no longer can congregate.
My gosh,
so it's
yeah.
become a big issue. So, you know, we're talking, these systems are going to be built from old panels that have been taken off of homes, 100-watt panel with a battery, like a large cell phone storage battery, a real simple charge controller. So low cost systems, you know, available wire.
Wow.
So that's more the style we're talking about.
That's amazing. So that's covering a lot of bases there, or I'd like to say two birds with one stone, but then the vegetarians get upset with me. But
two trees with one seed.
Two trees with one seed, two birds with one crumb, feeding both. You're hitting
yeah, nice.
A lot of different bases there, because it's not only making solar energy more accessible price-wise, but also making it lower waste because you're reusing things that are already in existence. Like, I think that is so fantastic.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm actually surprised by how many panels are in the waste stream that we can still be using.
And why is that? So, why do they get retired early?
You know, they get retired because, one, the cost of solar keeps coming down. So it becomes more and more easy to just install new solar.
Hmm.
But also, you know, panels have a lifetime. So in 10 or 20 years, they might only be producing 90% of what they produced before.
Right.
And also the newer panels can have higher efficiencies, so you can fit more power on the same size roof. Sometimes they get decommissioned because a couple of the panels will be broken and it doesn't make sense to try to piece a system back together because it'd be hard to find those same panels again.
Mm-hmm.
So they just install a new system. And so I have access to about 100 panels right now. And then I'm working with a California company. They're going to make a portal so that you can come and buy their old panels for significantly discounted prices.
Neat.
There was one more thing you said that I want to address, which is, these distributed systems, they really help protect the whole community. When you have some people in your neighborhood who are storing solar power and some people who are storing water, it really builds resilience and capacity to deal with sudden changes.
Oh, I love that. We did one episode with someone locally about electric vehicles and just the idea of having all of these electric vehicles that are ready and charged, and then suddenly there's a power outage. You can draw on all of these giant batteries worth of electricity to cover the bare minimum and like keep the fridges on or something until the power is fixed. But like, that idea of community comes back again, where you're taking care of each other. Everybody's storing something. This person's growing a vegetable garden. This person's storing their rainwater. This person has solar energy. And all of a sudden, we have this community resiliency, this self-sufficiency that goes beyond just your own home. I love it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing right now acutely the problems with our very elegant supply chain, right? So we've focused a lot on building, and by we, I mean as a large culture, we focus a lot on building very efficient supply chains. But the problem is that they come from afar, and also there's very little room for inefficiencies.
Right.
But those inefficiencies often, I mean, if you look at nature, and nature is not very efficient, right? Nature is very resilient. So there's a lot of redundancies. There's a lot of multiple paths. And so we can really help build capacity back in and resilience back in by storing our own resources.
Man, if there was anything else that you wanted to touch on that we haven't yet talked about.
Oh, there are so many.
All
I would
things.
Love to have another conversation.
Hours.
Maybe next year I'll come on with
yes.
more. The book is available from local bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So you can order from any of your local bookstores. Right now, our local bookstores in Northern California, a couple of them, or I should say, one of our local bookstores here in Arcata is doing curbside pickup. In fact, the next 20 copies of this book, they get all of the proceeds from. So it's a partnership to be able to kind of support our local bookstores more.
Amazing.
But so the book is available from your local bookstore. It might be a really good time to support them right now. The
yes.
book is also available on Amazon. And then also the book is available for free as a download.
I saw that. That's amazing.
It's just in its full, beautiful form. If you buy the book, the proceeds go directly to the Apropedia Foundation, which is focused on sharing these types of sustainable solutions between community members. We've been around for 14 years and visited tens of millions of times. And in fact, we've been edited 400,000 times by people all around the world.
Wow.
And, So the proceeds go back to support that if you do buy the book, whether that's Kindle, Amazon, or your local bookstore. But we just want you to have the information to use it. And so it's available for free at tocatchtherain.org.
Thank you so much for chatting with me today. That was so wonderful. And I'm really excited to share all this information with everyone.
Elizabeth, thank you. I loved your questions. And they felt very, very pointed and educated. And I was impressed. It definitely seems like you know a lot about this stuff already. So I appreciate having the time.
Oh, thank you. Thanks again for listening, everyone. If you want to learn more from Lonnie, you can head to his website, tocatchtherain.org, or find him on Instagram at Lonnie Grafman. Some other episodes you would probably really like if you enjoyed today's chat are number 39, Construction and Renovation, and number 49, Electric Vehicles. You can find both of those and many more in our archives wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to be in touch, you can send an email to practicallyzerowaste@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at practicallyzerowastepod. And this week, I'd love to hear if you're doing any rainwater harvesting, if you're using solar or wind power, if you're growing your own food or learning any resilient skills in any way, please be in touch. I'd love to share what you're doing with our awesome online community. That's all for now. Please stay healthy and keep each other safe. Have a great week, everyone, and talk to you soon.